Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Tuesday, February 27th. My name is Magnus Tiebold. I'm your host for today. And today we'll be bringing you part two of our special three-part series, The Seventh Artists on Radio, created in collaboration with the Orr Gallery. Also later in the program, Ayu Sakamoto will be coming up to bring her review of a recent classical music event. 2 weeks ago, we had a feature interview with cellist Spanish cellist Loretta that Ayu conducted, and she went to the event, and she's going to come back and give us her thoughts on that. That'll be coming up around 10:45. First, though, we have our feature for today, part two of the series, The Seventh Artists on Radio. This is a talk with artists Laura Brevner and James Harry, who are in conversation with Rick Harry, Cease Weiss, and Aaron Nelson Moody. The conversation is moderated by Orr Gallery Director Jen Jackson. Together, the artists discuss Coast Salish design principles and intersectional collaboration as it relates to Lauren Brevner and James Harry's exhibition, The Seventh, which was at the Orr Gallery this fall and winter. So here is our presentation, part two of The Seventh. And we will be bringing part three of this discussion on Thursday morning at 10 o'clock. Don't forget, Ayu Sakamoto is going to be here after this at about 10:45, so please enjoy.
But also our commitment to support the capacity of art to unsettle these conditions. We would like to welcome each of you to this really special panel today. And I'm very grateful for the vision of Jen Jackson, the Orr Gallery Director, in creating this partnership for our program today. Now I'll welcome Jen Jackson to speak. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on this beautiful afternoon for the seventh panel conversation on Coast Salish design principles in intersectional collaboration with artists James McCullis, Willapton Harry, Willapton Rick Harry, Tightsnut Cease Weiss will be joining us shortly, and Aaron Nelson Moody, also known as Splash, our wonderful colleague and friend, artist Lauren Brevner, and the star of the show, Baby Hannah, are unable to join us today as they are under the weather. I am Jen Jackson, my pronouns are she, her. I am the director at Orr Gallery and the curator of The Seventh. It is an honor to be here today and to welcome stories of the land from our esteemed panelists. The stories that will be shared this afternoon offer an active and ongoing acknowledgement that the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples and territories are timeless, that the rich and culturally diverse descendants of this territory are always in dialogue with the Hunkaminos and Squamish voices that echo upon the land. Today, artists will discuss Coast Salish design principles and intersectional collaboration as it relates to Lauren and James' exhibition 7 on view at Orr Gallery until February 10, 2024. Together, they will discuss the exhibition's principles of Indigenous representation and land-based gestures in contemporary art. The conversation that we will share today acknowledges calls for Indigenous sovereignty across and in solidarity with communities near and far. It offers an opening for discussion on the ways that we can stand with each other and direct our voices to powerful change. It is an honor and a pleasure for me to welcome a conversation between James, Wolafton, Cease, and Splash. I'll share a little bit about each of them and introduce them to you. We'll start with him. Internationally recognized Squamish artist Wolafton Osisi was born and raised in Squamish, and carries with him the rich ancestry of his father, Squamish Nation, and mother, Kwakwaka'wakw Nation. He was given his indigenous name by his father, Kulton, who was a hereditary chief originally from the Seymour Creek area in North Vancouver. Wolafton attended Emily Carr University and Capilano College, and credits both with helping him acquire skills and starting his career. His endurance and deep commitment to community has propelled his practice as an artist. He has received numerous honors and awards, including an honorary doctorate from Emily Carr University, the BC Achievement Foundation Award of Distinction for Lifetime Achievement, the Queen Elizabeth Diamond Jubilee Medal, and the Order of British Columbia. Healing growth and raising awareness of the environment are central themes in Wolafton's work. His focus on traditional stories and lived experiences uphold the ways that ancient knowledge can be called upon to heal individuals and communities. Aaron Nelson Moody, he, him. Artist, educator, and traditional storyteller, Aaron Nelson Moody, also known as Splash, I'll call you Splash for this talk, is a member of the Squamish First Nation who lives and works in Capilano Village on the North Shore of Vancouver. His practice engages Coast Salish cultural revival through knowledge sharing and traditional intercultural connection. Nelson Moody has spent several decades working in regional schools and with local community groups on projects that engage Indigenous representation and visual sovereignty. He currently works as an instructor in the Department of Fine Arts at Lanigara College, where he teaches Indigenous wood carving and principles of public art. Nelson Moody's Squamish name, Tossin Yakwala, means splashing eagle. According to stories, he was given the name after a canoe trip down the BC coast from Bella Bella, where his unique paddling style frequently soaked the paddlers sitting just behind him. The nickname stuck, and to this day, most people just call him Splash. Toys to Nutsy's wife, hello, Cease. Is a Squamish, Solo, Hawaiian, and Swiss educator, interdisciplinary artist, Indigenous ethnobotanist, and food security activist, engaged in community-based teaching and sharing. Weiss's 30-year practice connects storytelling and collaborative initiatives through restoration of Indigenous plants and natural species spaces. Weiss has been recognized for exchanging traditional knowledges and remediating relationships to land alongside themes of site-specific engagement, language revitalization, digital media, and weaving. Weiss has participated and exhibited at galleries, museums, festivals, and public spaces such as Vancouver Art Gallery, Morris Helen Belkin Art Gallery, Contemporary Art Gallery, and the Push Festival. Their work can be found in various collections such as the National Library of Canada, special collections at the Walter Phillips Gallery, the Banff Centre, and Vancouver Public Library. Since 2019, they have led the transformation of Oshway, New Growth, an urban Indigenous garden located in Vancouver, BC. They have received numerous honors and awards, including an honorary doctorate from Emily Carr University, City of Vancouver Artist Studio Award, the City of Vancouver Mayor's Arts Award for Film and New Media. So welcome, Wolafton, James, Splash, and cease, I'll come sit down with you, and maybe we'll act and we can start with you and hear more about your work with community and the ways that you work with community on healing and growth and education as part of your artistic practice, and the ways that you share traditional stories and lived experience through mentorship. And I see that you've brought some wonderful examples of your work, so I'll hand the floor over to you.
I got to talk and stick down. So when anybody holds a stick, I have the floor, no one else can speak. Yeah, it's been a good journey for me. Started to do artwork at the age of 5, and I was inspired by my older brother. My older brother was probably grade 7 at the time, and I saw his work, and I said, wow, I want to be able to do that. So I got down and I started drawing. This young man here, he was 5 too, and all was there standing there watching me. And I was thinking of myself at that age, wow, he was very interested. I sent him a picture of himself really watching me doing some work. And he just kind of allowed them to happen, be part of it. Be part of it, then it grows from there. It's and then like that with community. I let people participate in the project. And even if they took a few chips of wood off, I said, now you go tell people you carved this. I got my permission, you carved it. Even though the thing's 30 feet long. Little shaving, come on. You carved that one. Or even get community involved, like this recent one here. When I was laying down, I shared with the little ones. This was being carved at Whistler last summer. Any little child would come along, I said, sit in the canoe. Sit in it. And I had some little paddles carved too. Hold on to the paddle. Because when you become an adult, you're going to share with your family, your little ones, that you sat in that canoe. Because this canoe is going to stand, or this whole piece will stand for probably 60 to 100 years. And this, it could help educate all those little ones. And it tells the background of who we are, where we're from, how we can carry ourselves, what can we leave behind for the ones that aren't here yet. Right, so there's a lot of information here to help one grow in a good way. And his little brother, Stanley, he's learned the Squamish language. And it talks, and when they learn every morning, they say these words, that we all come from good people. We need to carry ourselves in a good way, respect one another, respect our teachers, respect ourselves, respect their environment. So there's a lot of teaching there, and that's what this is all about. And so we involve community, because this was like our written language, right? Whenever we had gatherings or feasts, when I got married, I didn't ask for gifts. I gave gifts. Gave out prints, gave out jewelry, gave out glass. So when those people pick those pieces up, they're going to remember what happened that time. And so we were more like what was traditional feast way. This one was based on our hereditary chiefs. Because really, our hereditary chiefs don't carry that power. We need to give them back that power. Because it'll bring our community back to balance, and our family back to balance. Because that's what that canoe represents here, is balance. The spindle whorl here represents the female part. So it's our balance. It's right in the middle of the canoe, but it's also in the middle of this whole bowl to symbolize our balance. That's our strength. And some people might call it a totem pole, but I left it blocked off here to represent house posts. Because we didn't carve totem poles, like we mentioned. No totem poles, they were house posts that were held up our home. Okay, that's where we got our strength from, was our home. So we got the bear to symbolize the power and the strength. This is a representative hereditary chief up here, But that didn't mean they were greater than us. They were just as equal as us. They would treat us the same. And then the sound of people. But actually, when this piece was lit, it surprised me. There's a serpent showing. When the light hits it up here, the grate around this area, there's a serpent facing us. And the serpent, there's a lot of stories behind the double of the serpent, which helps us get our strength. What can we, if there's something wrong, how can we overcome it? We're going to find our balance, our strengths. And then we have eyes on each side to remind us that we're all being watched. So, you know, to learn from ourselves, if we're being taught or being watched all the time, we're going to carry ourselves in a better way. We're being watched by the Creator, our ancestors, community, family, friends, and our conscience, ourself. That's what these Salish eyes also can represent, being watched all the time. So, better behave. Spread it further, like we've been to Scotland, caught our 34 poles in Scotland, and we kind of reversed it. After I raised all those poles up in Scotland, it's no longer called Scotland. It's now called Scotch-mish. Newfound territory, he said. Newfound territory. Yeah. So, I mean, we're just having fun with that, you know, we talked about it. And, you know, while we're carving over there, one of the elderly ladies, she came over and sat beside me. She says, while we're carving this pole in her community, she says, these don't belong here. We say, yeah, okay. I let her go off and let her finish talking. And I says, do you mind, I'm going to share why I'm here now. Is that okay? She says, yeah. So I shared with her why we were here, to build a community, to learn about one another. Then she also realized she's starting to get to know some of her own community members because we were building something, carving something together. And she came every day after that and she was helping carve. She was like 83 or something at that time. And like how the trees look after her elders. She'd been coming to lunch and said, come eat with us. Because they, you know, they were feeding us. No, no, I can't eat with you guys. That's your guys' food. No, 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 we look after them. You come eat with us. So she came and ate with us. So, you know, we've got to treat one another when people and be friendly and be very open. And we joke. We play around because in our culture, we tease one another. Mm-hmm. Right? So I stood over one of those, because we're all carving different pieces in a place called Strathcon. One guy, you know, he's a real great carver. I stood over his carving and go like this. I knew he was watching me. And he was getting offensive on me. They looked at me and said, no, no, I'm just easing you. Yeah, so I just made it look like it seemed it was balanced. Yeah, I always include people when I'm doing projects, you know, like, if you stand around too long, yeah, I'm going to put you to work. I said, well, excuse me, do you mind if I interrupt? I'm here to be interrupted, that's why I'm here. But I can say for Salish art, I started thinking about Salish art when I was on this journey to, it's called Sacred Run Across Canada. Russell Means and Dennis Banks, these guys were American Indian Movement guys that started at Wounded Knee. They went through a lot of hard times there. So as I was on that journey, I came across Charles Elliott's work. He's in, on the island, Vancouver Island. And he did Coast Salish art. I saw him on the bill and I said, oh, I like that. I'm going to have to get more into that. So, you know, I was inspired. Right? So, along with that, I started just bringing up, we need to start doing more Salish design. Because when it comes down to our identity, that's who I am. When I was in grade 10, one of my elders says, you guys aren't proud of who you are. Because we're all our Indigenous kids, we were in the classroom talking to us. I don't see you guys wearing anything that's Native, he said. I looked at everybody, he said, yeah, that's right. So I went home, got a book. It said Indian Cross. It's more like for the plains, so I'll start doing stuff like Plain Natives. I start making these necklaces and stuff and show them who I am. And one time I was walking down Bramble Street, this guy, he says, hey, brother, are you Lakota? Lakota? No. He says, well, what you're wearing, that tells me who you are. So now I have to think about that again. Then I started coming up with some more design work about who I was, actually. So that's why we're really focused on this, on this land, but more focused on Coast Sailor's design. And it's pretty awesome to learn about. Even for me, I didn't learn about it as a child, right? I had to grow into it and learn about it. This guy here, he's a better speaker than me. And the reason is, I graduated from a college. He graduated from a university. That's all I say, anybody's a better talker.
Thank you, Lactan, for sharing. Hearing Lactan talk makes me think about your decades-long commitments to community and the importance of community-based research and teachings and the ways that you work together with youth on the land and in the land in a way that is quite different than what James was sharing in terms of permanent works on the site, but also have these very permanent impacts and long-term impacts with youth. And I thought it would be nice to hear a little bit from you on that work. And I was reflecting recently on a talk that you did with James at Van Dusen Gardens, and you said something that really struck me, and I'm sure that you've said it many times, but in that instance it stayed with me about the way that the land will teach us or let us know. I'll be going to you.
Thanks, Kat. So many places in our territory have taught me that, like the Elaho Valley, which is actually how I really got to know Splashmore, because we both ended up there quite a bit in the mountains trying to make sure that work was being done right. And I really listened to the speakers of our nation and also from other places that came to talk about the land and saving it. And it just kept really hitting me in such a meaningful way how everything I heard people say was how much the land was teaching us. In places I've gone, one year I went to Northern California to visit a friend. She's an herbalist like me, ethnobotanist, and she's actually one of my very formative teachers in traditional medicines. And the odd thing is I started out learning about traditional medicines, but I couldn't find people in our community, and it was a mix of people still decolonizing and saying that we can talk about it. But my paths took me in different directions, and two different Mohawk women from different places came into my life. And when I went to visit this woman, there was a flood, and then the flood went down, and then she's like, let's go walk. I gotta see the land. She's like, the river's different. Everywhere she took me, like, it's all new to me, because I've never been here, so it's what it is. But for her, I really listened to the things she was saying and how the river, when it went up and came down, how it changed and transformed things in a different way. And it really made me think about our people and when we had our big flood and how that must have been so impacting to our people at the time, because so many places were, so all of our villages were flooded. And to have all of them flooded at the same time, and then that water subsided. And over the years, I keep hearing stories from different community members about their family stories of the flood must be coming out through them, I guess, because they say different things. And then I started working on building this community garden very close to Palatkin's place. And over the 15 years I've been there, that land has been teaching me so much, and it changes every year, and then I'll grow something, it won't grow. I'll try for, for 10 years to grow a calendula, and it's like, no, I'm not growing for you. I'm like, but I love you. Please grow. And then I started to see that plants would just appear, and I was like, okay, I gotta wait for what wants to grow for you. I gotta follow that, and I have to have patience, and I have to have love and understanding, and not be judgmental. But you're not the plant I wanted. Not about to say that. So, and I started to share that teaching with people because that's what I was observing, and I just really saw people transform on that land, but also when they brought themselves back to the land. And I think even those of us that feel very connected, there's still parts of us, because we live in a very colonial world now, that we have to find the ways to stay connected and to let the land keep teaching us and let the land help us understand how we can coexist better. And, you know, I think about the ancient teachings that I hear from so many elders, and about how in the long ago, all these things that that happened were all about, and you know, natural disasters would happen, and the people would have to respond. And they couldn't phone each other, I mean, not on a phone, but we could give messages. This is where the water is so important, and our drums. We could actually sing a song that had a meaning that somebody would understand. They could hear it on the water, it would travel. And I would think about those things, about how, you know, we're given the gifts as humans because we're supposed to be the smartest creatures on the planet, but we're not very good at being kind. At least, you know, some of us aren't very good at it, and some of us are very good at it, is what I want to say, because we wouldn't still have all the resources we have if the people from our ancestors didn't see and understand how to keep protecting what we had. And despite these natural disasters, we've survived and we've thrived. And so, you know, when we come to these stories, like what Palatkin was sharing about the predatory chiefs, and, you know, we're in a time right now where people are in a cancel culture, and where they want to cancel things out. And some people in our community are doing that, and they're trying to say, well, what did the hereditary chiefs ever do? And I was like, well, all the stories I've heard of the people that became the first chiefs saved our people during natural disasters. And so that really touched my heart when you were talking about, because that's why we have to really look at our ancient teachings, and that's why we have to really bring that back to today, where we have to really understand what we're honoring. And, you know, we have to listen to the young ones, but we also really have to listen to the old ones. And those of us in between are the ones that have to do that work to keep them connected. And I think, and that leads me into, like, the work I do with youth, where I just, for whatever reason, I just understood, you know, and I think my late 20s, I started to understand that the work that was coming my way was all with young people. And I didn't, and part of me just didn't feel worthy of it. And then I was like, okay, well, now I just don't have work, so I'll just do it. And then I started to, you know, realize that being worthy of something is about working towards it. And it's like, you know, becoming a master carver. You can't just carve something and you're like, I'm a master carver now. And you have to put that time in, and I've listened to young people that have listened to the masters, and they understand that you can't just become a master carver. And I've also talked with, you know, weavers, and actually Halactan's sister is my mentor, and I work with her at Suecia. And I just love how much I learned about love from her and from Halakha and the whole family. And I think about, you know, how can I share that with the next generation? So I think what happens is that you look at what you love, what gives you joy, and that is what becomes easier about bringing that to the next generation. So I really do love the earth, and I love to garden, and I love to, I really love, I really truly do love reinstating and remediating sites. it's like you see it, you're like, oh, it looks so much better, and oh, what was there before? And so I want things to look better, but not just aesthetically. I want the whole ecosystem underneath to feel better. I want the roots to talk to each other. I want the mycelium network to build up, and I want the soil to be fed every day in its own way. So I feel joy when I'm walking in the forest and I randomly see shells, and I'm like, ah, yes, you know, nature is doing its thing. The birds are trying to break open those shells, and they're leaving them in the forest. They're feeding the forest. They're, you know, we have faith as Indigenous people that we understand. You know, people will say, oh, but, you know, it was just empty land. And that was really sad, this place that has become Vancouver, that was just seen as empty land by the settlers. And we never saw that. We saw everything, not just in front of us, but down underneath. We saw it all. We saw all the beauty of everything it was, the giant, massive cedar trees that we all wish we would see in this era, you know. So I think about what can I give back to the youth of the future, and I, you know, with the work I did at Haushwise, I immediately argued that I had to have, I needed to be the one to choose the youth to work with, and I wanted them to be paid a living wage, and the first thing I said to them was, because on the first day, a couple of them were, as they said, late. I said, "You're not late," and they're like, "I mean, you guys have been here a couple hours." It's like, when did you leave home? And some of them were traveling from the island or Sunshine Coast, so they had to get up super early, get on buses, get on the ferry, get on other buses, and to get there. So it was a bit of a, they've already worked pretty hard to get there. And I'm like, your day starts when you leave home. So whenever you get here, however much time you can put in. And, you know, it made the curator a bit nervous. I was like, don't mess with my flow. I know what I'm doing. And throughout that, like after that, you know, I saw the youth kind of coming in like this, but after I said that, I saw their shoulders up. And what I saw was that they felt that I'd taken a weight off their shoulder, that I know I've carried, and that I know so many of us have carried. Like, you want to show up for work, you want to show people that you can do things, but for me, the remediation doesn't just come in planting things and putting and fixing the soil. It comes in remediating ourselves as Indigenous people that are forced to live in this occupied environment of colonialism, and how it fights, like, what our connection to the ancestors are. And so I've always been attracted to working with people like Loretta Todd and Kamala, her daughter, and how they talk about indigenizing the landscape, and how they talk about an Indigenous city, and what does that mean? And it's made me really think, you know, it's made me really proud that I do know the artists that I know, because I don't even know, I only know a handful, I feel, from our community. I'm still meeting people, but it made me realize that what each and every one of them is doing is helping re-indigenize the land and helping the future generations be able to feel that pride, you know. And I've seen the difference in my experience in the city and my daughter's, and we're two different generations. And these visual elements that have come to be in the land because of these artists, you know, I'm just walking around. One day I ran into Splash, and there he was carving this beautiful piece for Britannia, a center I go to a lot. And it was like, it just, it did that to me. It made my shoulders go up. It made me go, well, now I can walk by here and see something from my community. And I listened to my mother talk about when she went to school. She was in residential school and in day school, and then she was, you know, never able to afford to go to post-secondary. Even though she tried, she just couldn't do it financially. And so she talks about when she was in school, she learned about the Hurons and the Wendat. She heard about the Mohawk people. And she heard about all these people, but there was not one story about the West Coast people. Like, not one. And when she would try to speak about that, she was shut down. And I know when I went to school, I was still arguing for that. And then when my daughter went to school, it was already transforming. The work that people like these artists have done and are doing was helping to put that into place. So, you know, the work at Hostelwise, I can definitely say, was very influenced by these gentlemen here. Because, well, my mom lives next door to Dr. X over there, Professor X. And so I see the cedar all the time. I see these amazing people in their camaraderie and their love and the work that they put in. I hear the banter, the teasing. And all of that goes in there, and I know that things are going to be better, and they have been better. And as they said, there's just not enough of us, so just a lot of work. But when I did that work, I really, you know, I actually had spent some time, a few years, with one of their comrades, the late Hoya, Terrence Richard Baker. Also an artist and carver who spent a lot of time with all of these guys. So I really got to learn more about our Salish form lines, and I really, or not form lines, but our Salish forms, and how, you know, like, it may seem so simple, but it's very complex. But it helped me to focus on those three elements, and then I really wanted to put that into the land. And I really wanted it to honor the land and the community. And so I fought for these youth to be part of it. I fought for them to have a living wage. And I went a further step, and I fought for them to become the caretakers of the garden. And because now they've learned something, and then it'll be taken away. So here's a great project, and now there's nothing else like this, so you won't do anything more. And that is how we fail our young people, that we train them and then leave them with nothing. And you can see that James has been raised in this beautiful nest of incredible talent, that they all continue to carry him. And that's why he's able to walk in the strength and beauty he is, because he's taking all of them with him along the ride. And that's what I wanted for these young people. I wanted them to, you know, and I still hire them. So now I'm going to be doing a big, massive project in New Westminster and recreating a forest. So I put forward my argument. I want to work with you. I want them to have a living wage. I want them to be part of this. And they said yes to everything. And I was like, what world am I now living in? Because that was not as hard as I thought. And they're really respectful. And I'm working with city engineers. I'm working with almost every department in New Westminster on this. So it's a bit humbling and it's a bit terrifying. But and then I go back to, you know, folks like these guys, and I know that they went off to Scotland for several years, somewhere unknown in the beginning, and then they kept going back, and that they nurtured this beautiful relationship. And I know that they've been doing work, all of them. They work together, but they also work on their own. And so I look at people like this in our community, and those are, you know, literally my pillars of strength, that I can feel more confident because of the time I've spent around people that are the experts in this work. and to give that confidence to the next level, so that to the next generation. So that's always my journey. You know, if I'm going to do something, the work I do, I need to have people help me, but I don't want them to be left behind. I want them to be in that canoe and keep going. Yeah. And in fact, one of the youth I worked with on the Hofstra Wise, first of all, the first thing that she did was get the design tattooed on her by one of the other youth. But then she went off to her own community and went to one of their master carvers and learned how to carve a canoe. And up in the woods, and they brought it down to the water together. So it's like, we are in a changing part of the world, something we've all dreamed about, but we still need more. So help us dream that reality, is what I'm saying.
Thank you, Cece.
Thank you.
Hearing you talk about youth and the impacts and reverberations makes me think of James when you talk. He shares the pebble dropping into the water and the way that one single gesture and continuous gestures can reverberate through community. And I also really appreciated hearing you talk about the education system transforming over time and the ways that those kinds of commitments are long-standing and continuous, and the ways that you raise youth up and you hold them up with you and they're beside you. And I feel that with everyone here on the platform, the ways that you work together and you can turn to one another because you keep lifting each other up. And it makes me think about the work, well, I've done that you've done in the education system with Indigenous youth, but also like youth from all kinds of backgrounds.
And that is the conclusion of part two of our three-part series of The Seventh, Artists on the Radio. That is a co-production with the Orr Gallery and SFU Galleries here, of course, at SFU. Voices you heard in that discussion were artists Lauren Brevner and James Harry, and they are in conversation with Rick Harry, Cece Weiss, and Aaron Nelson Moody, with the conversation moderated by Orr Gallery Director Jen Jackson. That was part two of a three-part series. We'll be airing the final section on Thursday morning as part of Speak Up, starting at just a few minutes after 10 o'clock. Later today, part two that we just heard, along with part one, and the programs that are contained within, will be posted up on our websites. If you want to listen to parts of that again, or you want to go back and listen to part one, they will be available on our website at cjsf.ca.
This is Bird Note. When Day Scott teaches people how to take pictures of birds, she emphasizes observing birds carefully before picking up the camera. Sometimes that means choosing whether or not to even attempt a photo, like the time there was a rare bird in her area, a painted bunting. The bird kept visiting a friend's backyard.
We knew where the bird was landing every hour, but I was not guaranteed to get a good picture, and I did not want to set myself up for disappointment. And I went over there and I sat for hours and hours, and I had to make a decision. Do I want to try to get a photo or do I want to look through my binoculars?
A camera takes an image that lasts forever, but in the moment, Day would only see the bird with one eye through the viewfinder. In contrast, her binoculars would give her a high-definition view of the bird in real life. Finally, the painted bunting appeared.
I chose to see the bird out of the binoculars when it came. And I had the biggest smile on my face because I had never seen a painted bunting, and I saw it very clearly.
For Day, being an observer of nature is what lets her take great pictures.
I learned how to observe first, and if you get to know that species and its behavior, you have a really good chance of catching it in the behavior that you want to photograph. I teach right from the heart with my photography.
For Bird Note, I'm Jonice Franklin.
And joining me in the studio is Ayu Sakamoto. Hello, Ayu.
Hello.
You are here with a review.
Today I want to review the concert I attended about 2 weeks ago.
Yep.
And it's about the concert featuring the organ, pipe organ.
Mm-hmm. And who is the featured performer?
The performer is Spanish organist called Loreto Armandi.
Yeah. And you also interviewed Loretta, right?
Yeah, I interviewed her also 2 weeks ago before the concert.
Yeah.
And I really like her personality and
it was a really nice interview. That interview is available online on our website. You can go find it under the Speak Up heading for the program that aired on February 12th. IU spoke with Loretta, and tell us about the concert that you went to.
Okay, yeah, sure. The concert took place on February 16th at St. James Church in Vancouver and featured the talented Spanish organist Loreto Armandi. And Loreto is an internationally renowned organist known for her incredible skills and performances all over the world. And 2 weeks ago, I had the opportunity to interview her, and she told me how much she loves playing the organ. And she mentioned how the sound of the organ varies from instrument to instrument, which is one of the things she enjoyed about playing the organ. And she had a concert in Vancouver last year as well. And she said it was a wonderful experience for her, and she was looking forward to coming back to Vancouver again this year. And since talking with her in the interview, I also have been looking forward to seeing her play. At St. James Church, there was a big pipe organ at the back, and we could watch Loreto play on the screen at the front. And there are various kinds of music pieces, from Baroque to modern music, and I was very surprised by the different sounds the organ produced. Because I used to think that pipe organs only made powerful and majestic sounds, but I learned that they can also create very soft and delicate tones similar to the sound of a flute. And Loreto and her assistant would change the combination of pipes by pulling the stop knob, and it created a variety of interesting sounds. I never got bored and enjoyed every moment of the performance. Another surprise was that playing the organ seemed much more complex and difficult than I had expected. I knew that organists use multiple keys and play with their feet, but I didn't know that they sometimes rely on their feet as much as their hands to play. And it wasn't just simple melodies. Loreto also used her feet to play complex rhythms. And I was amazed at how smoothly she moved her feet without looking, even in fast-paced music, and how she created wonderful harmonies with the sounds created by her hands. I've been to many orchestra concerts before, but it was my first time attending a concert featuring only the pipe organ. And listening to its sound was so relaxing and even created a sacred atmosphere. So sometimes I feel like I was meditating, and the sound of organ has a way of transporting me to a different world. It also sparked my interest in the organ even more. And I love playing the piano, so if I have a chance, I'd love to try playing the organ. And also, Loreto is a wonderful organist, and I hope to have another opportunity to see her perform. And also she's had concerts twice in Japan. So because I'm from Japan, I hope she'll come to Japan again in the future. That's all from me. Thank you.
Excellent. It's a fascinating instrument, the organ, because these are the big pipe organs that are, you know, it's essentially built into the church.
Built in the church. Yeah, it was so big. And yeah, I was surprised because of the so many different sounds. And yeah, they actually often pull the stop knob. Mm-hmm. And often the sound changed. So, suddenly, it's the different sound and different mm-hmm. sounds. So it was so interesting for me.
Very interesting. It'd be interesting to have someone actually explain how the instrument works. Because, of course, mm-hmm. you tend to think of an organ, you know, keys and stuff in the foot pedals. But then there's this whole other range of controls that they have access to, in different ways manipulate the sound. It's quite something.
Yeah. And I played the piano, and some of my friends said, oh, you're so good at playing the piano. It looks so complicated because we need to use the both of my hands, but the playing the organ looks more complicated because feet and hands. So,
and you said she's maybe coming back this year.
I'm not sure about her schedule, but because when I interviewed her, she said, yeah, having a concert in Vancouver is wonderful. And also, she told me the experience in Japan. So, definitely she will come back. And
great.
Soon, I think.
So just before we finish up, what was her name again? And
Her name is Loreto Armendi, the Spanish organist.
Yeah.
Can I just tell the spell or of her? Loreto is L-O-R-E-T-O.
Yeah.
And Armendi is A-R-A-M-E-N-D-I. And she also has a YouTube channel and Instagram account. So if you want, maybe you can go to her social media or something and listen to her playing the organ.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, sounds like a fascinating performance.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else you're planning to go to soon?
The concert?
Yep.
I think I will attend some also concert, classical music concert or something. I really like classical music. So that's why also it was so fun to attend this concert because some music is familiar to me, mm-hmm. the Baroque music, and I used to play in the piano.
Excellent. Okay, well, we'll be looking forward to your next review or any upcoming interviews.
Yeah.
And thanks for coming to talk to us today.
Yeah, thank you too.
All right. That was Ayu Sakamoto and her review of Loreto Armendi?
Armendi, I guess.
Yeah. Concert on the organ here in Vancouver a couple weeks ago. So thank you for that, Ayu. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. And we'll be back right after this bit of music. Boom. Bloodshot Bill. That was a track called Say to That, a little different than classical organ music. We're going to move on with a little update from Climate Connections, and then we'll finish up the show.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the 1930s, Danish pilots wearing suits made of polar bear fur flew open cockpit planes along the coastline of Greenland. From the air, they took roughly 200,000 photographs. The images were intended to be used for mapping, but now scientists are using them to see how global warming has affected Greenland's peripheral glaciers, which dot the land around the central ice sheet.
And these glaciers are really important to study because they contribute significantly to sea level rise.
Laura LaRocca worked on the project while at Northwestern University and as a NOAA Climate and Global Change postdoctoral fellow. Using the Danish images, military photos, and satellite data, the researchers found that Greenland's glaciers retreated throughout the 130-year study period, but their melting sped up over the past two decades.
Glaciers are now retreating at a rate roughly twice the rate observed over the 20th century.
She says the study highlights the urgent need to limit global warming.
It's just a stunning landscape, and it's really sad to see the loss of these glaciers.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
And we're just about out of time here for today's program. thanks to our co-producers at the Org Gallery for the seventh artist on the radio presentation. Again, we'll be featuring the final performance of that the final segment of that on Thursday at 10 o'clock. Thanks to IU for coming up today.
Yeah, thank you for, today.
my name is Magnus Tiefold. I've been your host today, and IU has been with us as well. Mm-hmm. We're going to finish off with a bit of music from Loreto Aramendi. Hope you enjoy. Coming up in a few minutes is Democracy Now!